Okay, welcome to Champaign County. This is a forum for the finalist candidates vying to be nominated to replace Congressman Tim Johnson, who's retiring, and the actual vote will be next Saturday. So this is an opportunity for us to give the voters of Champaign County an opportunity to listen to the candidates, to have a chance to ask questions. We've gotten quite a few questions, and just allow you guys to be part of the process. So first, as our tradition is, I'd like to mention the elected officials or those who's running for offices that have registered. So if I don't call your name, I'm sorry. I'll ask you if you're to wave your hand or whatever, but I'm going to go by what who registered. Sherry Brown is the chairman of DeWitt County Republican Party. Wave, Sherry, wherever you are, back there. Gordy Halton, current Champaign County clerk and running for re-election. Jim McGuire, running for County Board 4. Joan Dykstra, Savoy Village Board. Bruce Pillsbury, Macon County chairman of the Republican Party in Macon County. Sherry and Bruce are part of the group of 14 that will be voting, so welcome to Champaign County for both of you. Brendan McGinty, City Board. W.C. Ackerman, Finney Branch Commissioner. J.J. Farney, candidate for County Auditor. Katie Blakeman, candidate for City Clerk. And also, so you guys know that we are open to everybody. Just like I said on in the press releases, we're open to everybody. Say hello to Vice Chairman of the Champaign County Democratic Party, Ava. Where are you, Ava? Back there. Okay. Very good. And is it Michael Richards? Is Michael Richards with you? He is? He's not? Okay. Very good. Well, welcome to all the elected officials. I would like to give you the agenda and the format. We're going to allow each candidate to speak. And, Stephanie Holderfield, Champaign County Board. You walked in late. Sorry about that. Who did I not mention? Anybody want to wave their hand? The agenda and format. I had said originally 5 minutes for each, and I've been to a couple of forums, and I watched the candidates speak for 15 minutes, and they did a great job without redundancy. So we're going to give each candidate alphabetically 15 minutes to speak. After that, I'll come up, and they'll come up with me and stand here, and we'll ask questions that have been submitted. And I'll allow a person to answer and then other people to answer as well. And I'll rotate so not one person is always on the hot seat. So I'm trying to make this fair for everybody. Not a debate, no gotcha questions, hard questions nevertheless, but no gotcha questions. So just to give you guys a chance to hear them. We'll rotate the answers and we'll go from there. So right now, I'm going to allow the candidates to speak for 15 minutes each, and forgive me if I kind of wave at you when it starts becoming 15 if you're going long, but I'll be fair to everybody. So we'll start with Jerry Clark, and I'm going to ask each candidate, instead of me introducing them, they usually introduce themselves and tell about themselves, so I'm going to let them do it without me introducing them. Come on up, Jerry.
Hello, I'm Jerry Clark. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce my wife, who's here with me tonight. Lene, can you stand up? And happy Mother's Day to everyone. We have four kids, so tomorrow's a special day in our household. My name is Jerry Clark. I live here in Urbana, Illinois. I was born and raised in Sangamon County, which is another big part of this district. My father was a Korean War veteran. He was a Marine over in the Korean War, and he came back to Central Illinois to raise his family. Him and my mother got married. They had six children, and I'm the last of the six kids. He started a small business in Springfield, an auto parts store. Tragically, he passed away when I was 9 years old, but he taught all of us kids the importance and the value of service to our families, our church, our communities, and to our country. So we all took that away from there. I graduated from Pawnee High School and came over to the University of Illinois and got a degree in agriculture economics. My mother passed away when I was 21. While I was at the University of Illinois, I joined the ROTC program and went to the United States Army after I got commissioned. I spent a couple years learning to fly helicopters for the United States Army, and then I moved back to Springfield, Illinois, and got a job with the House Republican staff. I started out as a driver for the House Republican staff, and 12 years later, I ended as the director of policy for the House Republicans. In that time frame, we did a lot of great things. We did Chicago school reform. We rolled back the gas taxes. But the two things that I'm most proud of that I worked on personally was the anti-stalking bill and the anti-carjacking bill. And I got a quick story about the anti-carjacking bill. I was a young staffer at the time. It was in the early 90s. And there was a senator from Chicago, from the inner city, who was a Democrat, who called me up on the phone, and his secretary did, and said that he wanted to see me. So I called my boss first, and it was Emil Jones. I don't know if anybody knows him, but he called me up, and he wanted to see me, and I called my boss, and I said, hey, Senator Jones wants to see me. And the first thing he said is, what have you done? I'm like, I don't know. So I went to see him, and he told me a story about he got up at 7 o'clock one morning and didn't on a Sunday morning, didn't want to wake his kids up. So he went down to the local gas station and got the papers, and he had a 1955 convertible Chevy. And he was sitting in his driveway reading the papers, and he got carjacked in his driveway. And so the reason he wanted to see me is he wanted to sponsor the bill in the Senate, which he did, and it passed, and that's how we got the, it was called vehicular hijacking at the time, but today we know it as carjacking. After I left the House Republican staff, I went with Congressman Tim Johnson out to Washington, D.C. to be his chief of staff. So I worked for Tim for 10 years. I started his office up here throughout the district that we're in now, and I was his chief of staff, so I was in charge of both the Washington, D.C. office and the office here in the district. Tim has done a lot of great things. He was a mentor to me. The thing I think I'm most proud of is the constituent service program that Tim continues today. I helped Congressman Johnson set that constituent service program up, and I can tell you if I get the nomination that I will continue the same constituent service program that Tim Johnson runs today. You know, it's just as important. There's a lot of big issues out there, but if you have a Social Security case that has not been adjudicated right, that is just as important to people as the war over in Iraq or Afghanistan. So I will commit to you that I will continue that. The reason I'm running for Congress, or I'm trying to get the nomination, is because of my four children. The out-of-control spending out in Washington, D.C. has to stop. And every American wants the same thing. My wife and I, as parents, we want the same thing as our parents wanted. We want our children to do better than we've done. And I think that time is coming to an end. If we don't fix Washington, D.C., our kids and their kids will be drowning in the debt that we have caused. And I think that has to stop. The important issues for this district, the number one issue is obviously jobs. We need to bring more jobs back, and we do that. We bring jobs back by taking the regulation off of small businesses. As we travel around the district, the small business people are telling us that, you know, what would it take to add one more job? And they all say, get the government off of our backs, and we can add one more job. So I think they need stability. Agriculture is a huge issue in this district. Right now, we're in the midst of a farm bill that we do every 6 to 7 years. I think that's going to flow over into next year. I'd like to work on that, on the farm bill. Our farmers, there's a lot of regulation on our farmers, and every time that we pass a new regulation to a farmer, that comes directly out of his pocket because he's got no way to, to pass that cost on. Transportation is a big issue in this district. Also defense, a strong national defense. I believe we have to have a strong national defense. That is what keeps America safe. The University of Illinois is obviously a huge issue, especially here in Champaign-Urbana. It's the flagship university. I want to work with the university to continue to get research dollars for our university. And then there's local issues. I know Congressman Johnson got the Cloverleaf exit off of Curtis Road, and that opened up that whole corridor out there. In DeWitt County, there's a huge issue. They're actually trying to put a chemical landfill over the Muhammad Aquifer. Now, that doesn't make any sense to me. I have four kids that drink out of that aquifer every day, and to me, that is just unacceptable. So I will commit to you that I will fight that chemical landfill with everything I have. My military experience, I spent 27 years in the United States Army Reserves. I'm a pilot. I fly both helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft. I've learned a lot in the Army. It's taught me a lot about leadership. It's taught me a lot about consensus, and it has taught me a lot about what we can get done together if nobody's trying to take credit for it. I spent three tours of duty over in Iraq as a commander. I've had five company commands and a battalion command. I've earned two Bronze Stars and an Air Medal. Got one quick war story. I won't bore you, but I have one war story that involves politics. In 2008, August 2008, I was over in Iraq, and I got a call from General Petraeus to take him down to Basra, Iraq. And at the time, Basra, it's in southern Iraq, it was pretty hot, a lot of incoming fire and a lot of activity down in that area. Well, Senator Obama, at the time, he was running for president, but he was in Basra. He came to Basra, and General Petraeus wanted to go down and see him. So I flew the general down. We got to Basra. He said an hour and a half. And that meant that in an hour and a half, he'd be ready to go. So I went to the pilot lounge, which was some sandbags around a piece of sand. And I waited an hour and 15 minutes. And then I went back out to my airplane. And an SUV rolls up, and it's got General Petraeus and Senator Obama in it. And they get out, and they're speaking. And his plane was parked next to ours. And I was standing there, and Senator Obama saw me, and he walked up, and he comes up, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And the General Petraeus, didn't hear him say that. He was walking behind him. But he did hear my response. I said, I was going to ask you the same thing. I didn't think Democrats came where bullets were flying. And he was pretty shocked by that. Obviously, the general was. So he tells one of his aides to go get Joey. And I understood that was probably his photographer. And I said, "Hey, I don't want to take a picture with you." And Senator Obama looked at the general and says, "Order this major to take a picture with me," which he did. And Senator Obama put his arm around me and got a big smile on his face, and I'm standing there. And they take the picture, and then we get it back on our airplane and we leave. And when we get back up to altitude, the general comes up to the cockpit and says, "Well, what was that all about?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I worked in the State House in Illinois, and he was a state senator. And then I moved out to D.C., and so did he. And so, you know, I've known him. We're from different parties." And he asked me, he goes, you did all that in the Army. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm just a reservist." I think he was upset because I was his pilot and I was a reservist. And, you know, I didn't fly every day. But on my on my last day in theater, I got called down to General Petraeus's palace where his headquarters was. And I flew down there, and he presented me with a great big picture of Senator Obama and myself. And Senator Obama had written on it, "Jerry, thanks for joining the team, Barack." So I think I have the only copy of that picture, and it will never see the light of day. So that's kind of my military background. My professional background, like I said, I worked for the House Republican staff for 12 years. I ended up as the policy director. I've been a chief of staff for 12 years in Congress. I've worked for Tim Johnson for 10 years. And now I work for a guy named Randy Holkren, who's up north. He asked me to come help him set up his office, which I was glad to do. I think that that gives me a leg up in this race. You know, I know Washington, D.C. I know what it takes to get things done. And I wouldn't be your normal freshman congressman. I could hit the ground running. As far as my campaign experience, I've ran a lot of campaigns. I've ran a lot of legislative campaigns. I've walked precincts. I've walked precincts for Deb Finan. I don't know if Deb's in the room, but I've walked precincts for Deb Finan. I've helped with Senator Winkle's campaign, with Tim Johnson's, all his campaigns. I worked on the Bill Brady campaign and Jim Ryan's campaign. So I've got a lot of campaign experience. And I think if I get the nod, I can put a team together. My campaign manager is someone that has ran several campaigns from the presidential on down to local races. The chief strategist that we have is a guy named Carter Hendren. And, you know, some of you know Carter. He's probably ran more campaigns in Illinois than any other Republican. And I will commit this to you. I will be everywhere, and I will work tirelessly at this campaign. I will run a very, very aggressive campaign. I know David Gill very, very well. He's a nice guy, but he's way too liberal for this district. I've beaten him 3 times as a campaign manager. I want to beat him a 4th time as a candidate. So this is a good place for me to be. These forums, you know, this is my hometown. So this is a good forum for me. Okay, but I don't know everybody here, so I just want to give you guys an example of kind of what makes me tick. In 1999, I was a commander of a fixed-wing unit out of Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, and one of my pilots passed away while we were doing physical training, and his wife and kids, all they wanted to do was fly in one of his aircraft down to where the burial was going to be in Florida. And I checked with my battalion commander, my brigade commander, and they both said that that would be, you know, perfectly fine. But it was over a holiday weekend, and I didn't have this piece of paper, which was orders to take them. So 7 a.m. on Tuesday, the time came that we needed to launch the aircraft in order to get them down there, came, and I didn't have those orders, but, you know, the funeral was going to happen, so we went ahead and launched the aircraft. I get to Florida, I turn my cell phone on, and there's some bean counter from our division on the phone that says, whatever you do, don't take that family down to Pensacola. You're not authorized to do that. I told him the story that we were already in Pensacola, and he said, well, don't bring them back. You know, that didn't push the common sense, you know, phase there. I wasn't going to tell a widow and her kids that we weren't going to take them back. So my battalion commander called me, and he said, if you take them back, you will be relieved of command when you touch down in Wisconsin. And I, you know, I said, so be it. You know, this was the right thing to do. So I loaded the family up on the aircraft, and we start to taxi out, and there's a ground stop because there's lightning within 5 nautical miles of the airfield. So we taxi back to the FBO and go look at the weather, and there's a huge storm in between Wisconsin and Florida. So I gave the family the option of either going across the ramp and buying an airline ticket or, you know, flying back with us after a few hours of waiting. They decided to take the airline tickets, so I walked across the ramp, and I paid for their flights. It cost me $6,600 to have them fly home. But they never knew that the Army was going to turn their back on them after he spent 26 years flying our aircraft. And I didn't get in any trouble because I didn't fly them back. But I just wanted to leave you with that. I will try to do the right things. I won't always do the right things, but I will always make an effort to do the right things. And I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Right. I'm moving the microphone for you, Rodney. Come on up.
Leave it to Habib to do this on graduation weekend. Hey, first of all, I want to thank you, Habib, and thank the Champaign County Republicans for sponsoring this event. Obviously, we've been traveling around 14 counties, all of us, trying to get county chairman to commit to send us, not just to Congress when we beat David Gill, but to the ballot next week. I look forward to talking with you even more and all the rest of the chairman. But I do want to mention, there are four of us here, four great candidates. Any one of us. You've got a military veteran. You've got Miss America. You've got those of you who don't know Kathy Wassink, she's a local grassroots political activist, had a lot of success down in the Madison County area. Great candidates. All four of us are going to be better candidates than David Gill, and all four of us can beat David Gill. You know, overnight, the 13th District became a target on Nancy Pelosi's pathway to return to power. You know, we've seen the damage that Democrats can cause, and this is a race that we cannot lose. I stand here today to tell you why I am the best candidate to hit the ground running, not only against David Gill, but the National Democrats and their billion-dollar super PAC allies. With your guidance and advice, I plan to take a common-sense approach to serving you in Washington. It's going to take a team to not only win this election, but also to make me a leader that we can all be proud of. It's imperative that this team has all of you as captains. I respect your knowledge. I know the issues that your communities face now, but I need your help to get to know them better. I know the federal issues that affect your area, but I need your help to make the best decisions. As a candidate and as your congressman, I need you, all of you, and I need your common sense advice. I know the issues families face in Central Illinois every day because I've lived here most of my life. My mom and dad were small business owners, and I watched them struggle, make tough sacrifices so that my family could achieve the American dream. The hard work and challenges my parents face taught me how important it is for government to enact laws that and regulations that help small businesses to create jobs. This also gave me an interest in pursuing my career in public service. Watching and working for them was a wonderful experience that I had growing up. They worked hard, they invested in people, and they taught me how to provide top-notch customer service. But I got my interest in public policy because I listened to them, and they told me how you can do everything right, but when politicians and bureaucrats in Washington and Springfield enact burdensome laws and regulations, it may not matter. Because of these life lessons, as I said, I chose a career in public service. I grew up in Taylorville. Those of you who know this district, it's right in the middle, right in the heart of the 13th Congressional District. I still live there and raise my family there. I graduated from Milliken University in Decatur, Illinois. My wife, Shannon, wanted to be here tonight, but with three kids and our in-laws out of town, she had to be there to run them around. My wife is my best friend and my biggest supporter. She is she's a registered nurse by trade. She used to run the local emergency room in Taylorville at our hospital. And then she went back to school, got her master's degree, and now teaches our next generation of caregivers at St. John's College in Springfield. I mentioned I have kids. I have three. A 15-year-old daughter named Torin. She knows everything. Just ask her. And I have twin boys that are 11. I'm happy to rent them out for campaign contributions to show you how fast a house can be torn up once it's clean. Family is the most important priority in our lives. We are active in our church, our kids' school, and our community. I worked in our family restaurant while growing up. For the last 16 years, I've been projects director for Congressman John Shimkus. I've helped countless constituents cut through the bureaucratic red tape of Washington, D.C. I understand the importance of traveling to each village, town, and city in the 13th District. I've logged hundreds of thousands of miles in my car over that 16 years while meeting with local officials to show them a cost-effective way of how the government can work with them to address their local infrastructure issues. Infrastructure issues, issues that the federal government should be involved in. Roads, bridges, clean drinking water, sewage treatment. Just common sense. 2 years ago, I was asked to assemble and manage teams that helped elect five new members of Congress, and we gained nationwide recognition. was a volunteer-led effort, and I met many of you when you were working in that Champaign call center. We now have over 50 million pieces of data on file that all Republicans can use to help elect other Republicans. Nancy Pelosi, she didn't appreciate the job that the Champaign County Victory Center did in 2010, and she surely didn't appreciate all of our common sense in kicking her out of the speaker's chair. Recently, I had to make some tough business decisions at the Illinois Republican Party. They were on the verge of bankruptcy and over $300,000 in debt. It's now an organization with zero debt and over $300,000 in the bank to help elect Republicans in 2012. Some of these tough business decisions didn't make many Republicans happy, and that's okay when it's the right thing to do. When leaders make tough decisions, they should be judged on the outcomes and the success or failure of those outcomes. And I don't think anyone can argue that my decisions there have righted the ship and have put Republicans statewide in a much better position to win in November. It's common sense that you cannot spend more than you take in and expect to succeed. Success in planning, executing, and winning is never easy, but losing is never an option. Recently, some friends and supporters in my hometown, unbeknownst to me, passed some petitions to urge the county chairman who are here to appoint me to this vacancy. I was very humbled by that opportunity and their efforts. In less than a week's time, they passed petitions and got over 700 signatures, more than enough to be put on the ballot if we would have had a congressional race to run for. I keep getting reminded when I'm out in public that they stand ready and willing to campaign the minute this appointment is made. The support of my home area has been overwhelming and also very, very humbling. The courage it has taken to stand up to Republicans and Democrats alike throughout my career in public service is the same courage that I intend to take to Washington. Courage does not mean just standing up to the Democrats, but also standing up to John Boehner and the Republicans when they're wrong. It means being a leader immediately after winning in November. This district needs a congressman who is going to not just cast a vote the right way, but build coalitions and lead the charge in getting enough votes to make real substantive changes to the way that Washington operates. With your common sense guidance and advice, I intend to be that leader for our agenda. I am a conservative. I am unabashedly pro-life. I am unabashedly pro-Second Amendment. Our families are facing problems that have to be fixed and fixed now. Obama and the Democrats in Washington and in Springfield, for that matter, they're out of control. Their solutions always involve raising taxes and spending more money. America and Illinois cannot survive their onslaught and the $15 trillion in crushing debt. That's just common sense. Obamacare has to be repealed. America cannot afford the $2.6 trillion price tag. And Americans, all of us, we cannot cede control of where and when to seek medical treatment to a faceless bureaucrat. Healthcare hits home for me. My wife, Shannon, is a 13-year colon cancer survivor. She was misdiagnosed for months because, you know, 26-year-olds can't get colon cancer. Luckily, she was treated, and she is doing wonderful today. We've had our two children, our twins, after her treatments, by the grace of God. But I got to tell you, with the enormous bureaucracy of Obamacare, I'm not too sure we might have had the same results today. The 13th District has an abundance of top-notch medical facilities in all the metro and mini-metro areas. Healthcare delivery is where David Gill is going to try to contrast himself with our candidate. I stand ready and willing to stand toe-to-toe with him and debate him on any healthcare-related issue that he wants to debate me on. Together, we can identify ideas and methods to increase the medical services to areas identified as underserved. I recently met with the CEO of Decatur Memorial Hospital, and you know what? We agreed that community health centers are avenues to save money and provide primary care to those who need it the most. America needs a market-based approach to create a healthcare safety net that will cover the uninsured and the underinsured. And Habib is on the front line of that with his business in administering healthcare savings accounts. We have to push for an all-of-the-above energy approach. We've got to do it now more than ever. Coal-fired power plants are being attacked by Washington bureaucrats. I will fight to find better and cleaner ways to burn Illinois coal and create an environment that will lead to thousands of good-paying jobs. Now, we all know government doesn't create private sector jobs, but the Democrats in Washington are doing everything they can to kill them. Coal is abundant, cheap, and is key to adding to our baseload generating capacity. Wind, solar, and hydropower alone cannot provide America the energy that we need and that we beg for every time we turn the lights, turn them on, turn them off, turn them on, turn them off, and also even when we surf the net. The energy sector has to be a key to restarting our economy and lowering unemployment. We have to use ethanol and other homegrown fuel solutions to lessen our reliance on foreign oil. The Keystone Pipeline has to be approved. It's common sense that America cannot continue to be beholden to the Middle East. As your congressman, I will aggressively protect Illinois agriculture. Illinois feeds the world, and you know what? How many farmers we got in here? It's underappreciated what you do. It really is. Farmers understand budgetary constraints, and they're willing to do their part to reduce debt, but they face great uncertainty every year. The next farm bill has got to include a strong safety net to mitigate risk, and that means crop insurance and other risk management programs have to be strengthened. We have to support programs for conservation, but on working lands. Rather than, we can't just keep setting aside fertile farm ground that can feed our economy and also feed our families. We also have to stop the Democrat assault on farmers and small businesses through regulations from the EPA and other agencies. That's just plain common sense to me. The death tax should be dead, and I will not rest until it is. And when government spends money it doesn't have, you can count on me to never, ever authorize or vote to bail them out. And don't get me wrong. There are some government programs that we need and that our families rely on to survive every day. Those programs should be the exceptions rather than the rule and should never, ever create generation after generation of those living off of others without working. The 13th District, it contains more educational institutions of higher learning than any other district in the state of Illinois. And as your candidate and as your congressman, I will sit down with their leadership and I want to discuss their current partnerships with the federal government and see how we can make them better and stronger. I want to work with them to ensure that they remain the powerful economic engines in all of our local communities. I also have a plan. I'd like to make sure that we take a little bit. 1 minute? Okay, that means five, right? I stand here today to tell you why I'm the best guy to beat David Gill. All right. I'm not starting over. You're welcome. I got an idea. I'd like to find a way, once we cut spending and we put together our budget, to create a pool of funds that universities here in Illinois can compete against each other for so that they get some federal funding to tell us how that they're going to give us some innovative ideas and approaches to dealing with problems here in the state. We got to unleash the entrepreneurial spirit of our educational leaders and, more importantly, our students. And when we do that, you know what we're going to find? We're going to find solutions to problems that you and I have never even dreamed of. We have to have that. We got to have it because that's how we leave a legacy for our children and all of our grandchildren that we can be proud of. A legacy that includes an America that spends less than it takes in. In America that invests in our military and offers peace through strength. And we have to have an America that leads the world economically. We should settle for nothing less. I'm humbled by this opportunity today. Habib, thank you very much. Did I get all that in 1 minute?
You're good.
Good. Let's work together, all of us, no matter who we choose. I'm just a little biased. No matter who we choose, let's make sure that we fight together to ensure that Nancy Pelosi never, ever again returns to power. Thank you very much for your time.
Good evening. I like the crowd participation already. But I won't make anyone chant or anything like that. My name is Erica Harold, and I'm seeking this nomination because I'm passionate about advocating for the interests of the 13th District, and I believe that my background and life experiences uniquely equip me to reach out to voters in this district who may not traditionally vote for Republican candidates. My roots run deep in central Illinois. I was born and raised in Champaign-Urbana. My grandmother, Mary Louise Tanner, has lived here for more than 50 years, and she's here today. If you could raise your hand, I won't make you stand up. And my parents still live just about 5 minutes from the University of Illinois. I attended Salem Baptist Church under the leadership of Reverend Claudie Shelby and Stone Creek under the leadership of Pastor Gary Grogan. I graduated from Urbana High School and then the University of Illinois. I also had the honor of representing the state of Illinois in the Miss America pageant and was crowned Miss America 2003. I used the scholarship money that I earned as Miss America to pursue my legal education at Harvard Law School. While at Harvard, I had the opportunity to hone my advocacy skills. I was a finalist in the school's moot court competition and argued my team's case before Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. It was one of the most thrilling and terrifying experiences of my life, and I keep wanting to do it over and over again. I'm currently a lawyer at a law firm and represent clients in state and federal courts throughout the country. I represent businesses in a wide range of industries, and I represent religious and not-for-profit organizations in connection with First Amendment religious liberties issues that they may face. For the past 5 years, I've also had the honor of serving on the National Board of Directors of Chuck Colson's Prison Fellowship Ministries. Prison Fellowship is the world's largest outreach to inmates and their families, and it has chapters in more than 110 countries. At Prison Fellowship, there's an understanding that although people must be held accountable for the crimes that they commit, there's a deeply held belief that no life is beyond redemption. Through my service with Prison Fellowship, I've visited maximum security prisons throughout the country, I've helped with the Angel Tree Program's outreach to inmates' children, and I've delivered a faith-based message to inmates on California's death row. Mr. Colson, the founder of Prison Fellowship, was a mentor to me, and he just recently passed away. I'll be attending his service this Wednesday at the National Cathedral. But his legacy of encouraging people to stand up for their convictions in many ways inspired my decision to enter this race, because this election has important implications for the direction of our country, and I want to stand up and be counted. At stake in this election are two competing conceptions of government. On the one hand, there is the view that the proper role of government is to manage the affairs of its citizens and to increasingly regulate businesses. On the other hand, there's the Republican conception of limited government, which represents a belief that citizens should be trusted to manage their own affairs. And it also represents the belief that businesses operate most profitably and can create the greatest number of jobs when they are unburdened by unnecessary regulations. It is that unshakable and unquenchable belief in the fruits of freedom. In order to win this election to represent the 13th District in Congress, which is now considered by most analysts to be trending slightly Democratic, Republicans must reach out and earn the votes of those voters who do not traditionally vote for Republicans. We must explain how the values of limited government, protecting the sanctity of life, transcend race, gender, and age, and can empower all Americans. It will not be sufficient to simply rally the base. We must expand the team. And I believe that I'm the candidate best equipped to try to engage those new voters. I've had a lot of experience reaching out to people who have not traditionally voted for Republican candidates. I think that's probably because I'm not the stereotypical Republican. But I had the opportunity to serve as the youth coordinator for State Senator Patrick O'Malley's campaign for governor. And I traveled to college campuses throughout this state, including many of the campuses within this district, to engage students in the political process. We worked not only to earn those students' votes for Senator O'Malley, but also to ensure students that their participation counted. Right now, so many young people have lost faith and trust in their government. They need to know that their votes count, that there's somebody who's listening to them, and there's somebody that they can trust. When they see people be arrested and indicted on ethics investigations, they wonder, why bother? Why should I even engage? They need someone who's going to say, I'm going to do my very best to be ethical and to make you proud of me and the vote that you cast. I also had the privilege of being involved in President Bush's reelection campaign. I was a delegate to the National Convention, and I spoke during one of the convention's evening sessions regarding the importance of faith-based initiatives. Coalition building will be essential to success in this race. I served on the National Steering Committee of W Stands for Women, and I was involved in efforts to show that lowering taxes and letting women keep more of their own money, as opposed to paying it to the government in the form of higher taxes, is truly what empowers women to forge their own economic destinies. Campaigning with First Lady Laura Bush was probably one of the highlights of one of my experience with W Stands for Women. And it would be my goal, if selected as the Republican nominee for this district, to show that there is no war on women. In fact, Republican principles show there is economic empowerment for each of us. Reaching out to African American business leaders was also one of the essential components of our outreach efforts. I participated in a multi-city national outreach tour with then RNC Chairman Ed Gillespie and other key Republican elected officials. Our goal was to make the case that lower taxes on businesses enabled them to operate more efficiently, more profitably, and create more jobs. These benefits help not just businesses, but also those who are unemployed or underemployed and simply want a job to support their families. Essential to the success of these outreach efforts is experience engaging the media and presenting Republican principles and ideas in a compelling and persuasive way. When you are the candidate, you are going to be pegged with questions right off the bat. You have to be able to speak succinctly and persuasively, and not just use traditional Republican sound bites, because that makes people tune out. It's finding creative and attractive ways of telling a story and framing the issues in ways that matter to people's lives. And I've had that experience. I served as a political commentator on a show on MSNBC, and I've discussed policies on TV shows such as The O'Reilly Factor, Hannity and Combs, and Good Morning America. And I've presented policy reports at the National Press Club. Because this race will be a battleground race, it will quickly become nationalized. And the ability to garner media opportunities and engage the media is essential and crucial to the success in this race. If I was honored with the nomination and was elected to Congress in November, I would focus on a few key priorities. First, I would prioritize reducing the national debt, which has now reached almost $15.6 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that if current tax and spending policies remain in place, the national debt will be close to 100% of the GDP within just a decade. This is fiscally unsustainable. Because we know that spending for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid will compose 64% of the federal budget in 2020, we must be willing to consider meaningful ways of addressing these programs. I would also prioritize obtaining a seat on the Agriculture Committee so that I could play a role in shaping the bills that will most affect this district. I would be a strong proponent of a comprehensive crop insurance program to serve as a risk management tool for farmers. And I would fight to protect renewable fuel standards. I would also explore how a move to a blend of 15% ethanol could spur job creation in the 13th district. I would also work to reduce the scope of regulations that provide no significant benefit to consumers, but burden the ways in which businesses operate. As a lawyer, I've represented businesses in cases involving Dodd-Frank and other financial reform regulations. And I found that some of the provisions of these laws impose significant burdens on businesses without providing any sort of benefit to consumers. And I would use my experience as a litigator litigating these issues in state and federal courts to try to stem the tide of this overregulation. And I would also stand with the unborn to protect the sanctity of life. This is an election where the stakes for our country could not be higher. and it would be the ultimate honor and privilege and humbling experience to serve as the representative for the 13th District and to fight to protect your interests and ideals each and every day in Washington and to be someone of whom you would be proud. Thank you, happy Mother's Day, and may God bless each of you.
Good evening. I'm going to try to take this off. Here we go. Good evening. My name is Kathy Wasink, and I live in Shipman, Illinois. But let me step back and tell you where I came from. I was born in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, but I spent most of my upbringing and graduated from Civic Memorial High School in Bethalto, which is part of Madison County. My parents are here this evening, Don and Mary Lee Kazee, and I really appreciate their support. Now, like any conservative couple, my husband's actually working tonight. So he sends his best. My husband, Steve, and I've been married for 26 years. And he is a solid rock. And if I go, he goes. And so we are a team. And he sends his best wishes. We have two children. One is 22, and one is 25, almost 25. And I have a wonderful daughter-in-law and a future son-in-law. So I feel very blessed to have a well-rounded family and to take that context from. I also am a businesswoman. I co-own a therapy company named Therakids. My partner and I have been doing this for 15 years. 15 years ago, we put $1,500 down on the table apiece and started a company. Today, we are extremely solvent. We could shut our doors tomorrow, hopefully not, but we will shut our doors tomorrow. And even in this economic situation in Illinois, we are very, very viable. And we have a good, solid company. We started out with one employee. So our first Christmas party was actually three of us at the tea room. And we've increased it to 25 women. We do accept men, but unfortunately, we don't have any right now. But we have 25 women who work for us. Now, where are my districts that I work at? Well, if you can imagine, I live in Shipman, Illinois, right outside of Litchfield, about an hour south of Springfield. I wake up every morning in the heart of the 13th. I go to work in the heart of the 13th. My businesses are in 7 out of 14 of the counties in the 13th. One day I'll travel to Taylorville. The next day I'll travel to Bond. Next day I travel to Madison, or I'll travel to Macoupin. We have business in Calhoun. So I understand, and I'm in every district and there. I might travel 500 miles a week. Someone's asked me, well, how can you do all this if you know, how are you going to coordinate all of this if you're actually got the nomination? I do it already, so it's not a problem for me. Like I said, I lay my head every night in the 13th, and I am right there with the people. I also attend a church in Bethalto. We are Cornerstone Assembly of God, and we're there every Sunday. You know, we're not one of those people who are like, well, are we going to go to church today? We're like, no, we're going to church today. I've also developed a special needs class there at our church as well. But let me step back and say about my business. I work, and we service over 500 students a week for special needs, ages 3 to 21. I also have 86 school districts that we work with in all of those counties. So I hear the needs of every single person, whether or not you are affluent or whether you're not, whether you're struggling. I see parents coming in and saying, my Medicaid for my child has been cut off and I can't get a wheelchair, or I have to move. I see, since I do so many districts, I see kids pop up all the time in different districts because they're not able to stay in the same home because they're starting to have to go and live with family. I see all that. So I, as a business owner and the only business owner in this entire race, I understand what it is to make a job, to keep a job, for payroll. I understand what it's like to have regulations. And I understand at the end of the year when you do your taxes and they go, oh, by the way, guess what? You got another tax from the state or federal government because of your business. I understand all of that. And that, I think, makes me very qualified and unique in this situation. As I said, I'm an occupational therapist, almost 30 years. I graduated from a state school, too, but I graduated from the University of Texas Medical Branch. I would have loved to have gone to U of I, but unfortunately, my father, when I graduated in 81, Amoco left the area, And I, you know, back then you didn't think about it as jobs leaving. You just went, oh, okay, well, that's fine. And so my dad decided to go to Texas because that was the biggest plant. And that's where I went to school, was the University of Texas. My husband's from Buffalo, New York, and we met in Texas. And we had two kids down there in Texas. And then I always wanted to come back home. So we, in 1982, came back home to Bethalto. And there was nowhere else I wanted to go. We moved to Madison County, out of Madison County to Macoupin 3 years ago. Guess what? Reduced our taxes by 66% just moving. That was a great break. I have a little hobby farm, 1 acre. Hobby farm is code word for you pay a lot for the animals, you spend a lot of time there, but you get no money out of it. But I do enjoy it, and I get up every morning and I have chores. I'm a I'm a faith-based woman. I am totally supportive and 100% advocate for the rights for life, and I will defend the unborn child no matter what. I also am very much of a right to bear arms, Second Amendment. I have a FOID card, and I have a concealed carry card, and I've had them for a long time. You can check. And I definitely believe that we have the rights to bear arms in this country, and I will defend that as well. And I will also defend the child as another perspective, because I said I'm a medical professional. Unfortunately, we have a man in this race named Dr. David Gill, and I'm sorry, I have to beg to differ. I don't think he's a nice man. I don't know him, but anybody who is going to tell me that they are 100% for any kind of abortion you've got, I have to question that character. And my concern is that being the only medical professional in this race, I can stand toe-to-toe to him when he says, oh, by the way, and you know, the certain procedure, or oh, by the way, women are not getting the reproductive, the birth control, the things that they need. I can say, no, you're wrong. And here's why I know that. A, I'm a woman, and only women can address that. These guys are great in this race. They're awesome, and we need them. But I'm sorry, it is the Republican women that are going to have to step up this time and do this. Now, let me tell you specifically why this Republican woman has to step up. It's because I'm the only one who can defend that. I can defend when he talks about that, because I can say, you know what? I work every day with that special need child, the one that you may have not thought was worthy to be here, but I do. And I've never seen a parent say to me, gosh darn it, I forgot my appointment at the clinic. And so what they're telling me is, I love my child. These children are beautiful. And for this man to sit there and say possibly that that person couldn't have been here and that was okay is not correct. So I see that, and I can defend that more so than anybody else can. Another thing that I am a grassroots organizer, like was said before. 3 years ago, my husband and I started the Riverbend 912 group. What is 912? 912 is about being that person the day you were after 9/11. It's about stepping up, educating yourself on absolutely everything, educating yourself on who's on the school board, who's on the county board, who's in the state, and who's in the government. And that's what it's about. But let me tell you what sparked that for me. What sparked that for me was there's a little obscure program on the TV. It was never came on again. And it said, in San Diego, a couple wanted to hold a Bible study, but they had to get a permit to do it. But the people who had a Tupperware party didn't have to. And you know how you have those, okay, that's it, I've had it moments? That was my it, I had it moment. And I called up and I said, hey, you know, let's start something. And there were six people around a table. Now there's 600 people on our email list. And we have active participants all through the 13th, with 14 counties. So what I'm saying is that what happened was we build a group. And I hate to, I'm not an I person, this is really difficult, but my husband and I led the way on that. And that group then formed other groups in Jersey and in Macoupin and Christian, and it went all the way through. And then we tag on to other conservative groups like the Tax Enough Already Party and the other conservatives out there. So what I'm saying is I have an army that's ready to go. Actually, they're already going. I can't keep them controlled. They're already planning fundraisers. And they are sparked and excited. Now, who else is excited? Well, I got this email, and I was so incredibly shocked, and I shared it with the party chairman last week, right before I went up to, if you could imagine, 14 men and women in a room, and you go in there, And it was from the Constitution Party. And I don't really know the Constitution Party. I met Randy Stufflebean about twice casually, like in a forum like this. But they sent me an email and said, please share this. Because right now, you know that third party out there is really kind of getting chic, right? A lot of people are going, unfortunately, a lot of candidates are going after third party. And that's a sad thing because we don't want to divide up the vote. We have to stay focused. And what they said in this email was that if Kathy Wasink was a Republican candidate for this position, we understand that she is a conservative through and through, and that we will stand down, and we will not put somebody in this race because we want to have principles over politics. Because what the, and I was like, oh my gosh. So I said, you know what, I'm a Republican. They said, we understand, we're not asking you. But we want to extend a bridge to the Republican Party because we know we can't do it alone. So I felt that was pretty powerful, so I wanted to share that with you. So I think I'm the only candidate in the race that just took out a third party. Now, I got this other phone call the other day, and again, these things aren't unsolicited. I don't really, I mean, these people are wonderful. I know you know somebody, but you don't know them that well. Well, there's this one lady that called me from one of the school districts I work at, and she's like, Kathy, and I won't say her name, I'm with the teachers, and I'm with the teachers union, and what can we do for you? And I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, and so I called her today. I'm like, well, you know, and she's like, what's going on? Because I still get the same look. I mean, I'm in the middle of IEP meetings, which is an individual education plan, and I'm sitting with parents, and then somebody turns and says, now what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I'm kind of running for Congress, I think. And they're like, they go, oh, wow, because I've always kept my political stuff pretty private. They'll say, good, go. Go be one of us. Go up there, don't get corrupted, and go up there and stand up. Every single body says that. So I was talking today to this lady who I was completely shocked, and she said to me, she goes, what can we do? And I said, well, just get the word out. You know, just if you want me, you know, to represent your areas, get the word out. She said, we've been praying, and finally, somebody came through. Now, it's not me personally. I mean, it's what I represent. I represent somebody that everybody knows in these different districts. And I represent somebody who says, you know what, she's just like me. She's a mother, and she's a wife, and she's a business owner, and she's a woman of faith. And guess what, by the way, once a month, we have a grassroots group that comes in. We got about 100 people there, and she's an activist. Now, I do not mean any disrespect to the gentleman here, but I keep hearing how everybody is going to go up there and do stuff. Some people have been there for a very long time, and we still have problems. So I hear that there's a learning curve. And I'll tell you what, I've made a commitment to these party chairmen that, yes, I am new, but there was also another new candidate last time called Bobby Schilling, who we helped get elected, and Sam McCann. And I think they're doing pretty doggone good right now. I talked to some of Bobby's people the other day, and they're doing awesome, and they caught up on that learning curve. But I'm going to do something even extra special, because hey, I'm an employer. And I'm an employee, because as you know, if you're an employer, you're everybody's employee. But, okay, here's what I vowed to every party chairman, and I vowed tonight to Tim Johnson's staff. If you are a person of character in that staff, which I hear there are a lot of them, and if you come and we'll sit down, I told them, I said, the next day after I get this, we're sitting down. I am not going to get rid of any person in that staff that has my values and that they values, that they match up. We're working together. It is not fair that one person loses their job in this race. And so there's going to be little to no learning curve for me because I'm going to have great people who already know what they're doing. Now, if they don't have my values, guess what? We will replace them with somebody who does. And what are my values? They're principles and ethics. Let me say this. Last Friday night, before the biggest interview of my life, I'm sitting there going, I think some people are bringing lots of stuff, you know, lots of papers and stuff. And I'm like, holy crap, I don't have anything. And so then I'm like, okay, what do I bring? Well, here's what I started thinking about it, and I talked to my good friend, and she's like, okay, we're going to bring all this stuff. So I started to do that. And then there's, you know how sometimes you have a quiet voice that says, take three things. And I'm like, okay. So, and if I can tell you all the God miracles I've had in this last week, I would have to be telling you, I would be crying. And I know there's no crying in Congress, so I can't do that. But here's what I would do. He said, take three things. And here's what I did the next day. I went into this room of very professional men,
and women, and I put my 5x7 picture of my kids down. And I said, why am I doing this? It's for them. It's for your kids, and it's for your kids, and it's for your grandkids. That's why I'm here. Number two, I guarantee I'll give you my coach purse if you find out that I don't do this. Every day I carry a Bible and a Constitution in my purse. And I pulled out my Constitution and my Bible, and it's a little one, and I said, remember that story I told you about with the San Diego? And that's what sparked it. But you have to be grounded in some principles. And you have to be grounded in faith, especially up there. Because I love John Mellencamp, and he said, if you don't stand for something, you're going to fall for anything. And I truly believe that. So I stand on my principles and my faith. And the third thing was the Constitution. Why the Constitution? That's kind of a strange thing to carry in your purse. Well, you have to understand, when you lay that Constitution down, then it's an equalizer for all parties. Because now you've taken all those politics out of the Constitution, out of the equation, and now you just got the Constitution, and now you've got principles, and you've got guidelines. Because I'm sorry, I totally agree with whatever somebody said here tonight about the policies that they would do. Yes, yes, yes. Those are Republican policies, and that's what we need to do. Republicans have great ideas. But Republicans do not have a monopoly on great ideas, nor do the Democrats. But when you put this Constitution down, you have now opened up a dialogue. And that's why I carry the Constitution with me, to remind me of that. So, in conclusion, I'm a woman of faith. I'm the only business owner in this race. These people are lovely. And I agree that this has been an awesome process. My daughter was doing my hair today, and she also bought my outfit. I'm doing this whole race on two pantsuits, so and a skirt. But anyway, she said, Mom, I don't get it. She's 22. And she said, I don't get it. How did you get to do this? I said, well, Erin, anybody can. And that's the great thing about our country. Anybody could have done this. Any of you out here could be up here. We need that enthusiasm. And that's what our grassroots groups do. They give us this enthusiasm to say, let's get going. We helped Sam McCann. We moved him 20 points against Deanna DiMuzio. If you don't know who Deanna DiMuzio is, drive down 55 South. It's DiMuzio Highway. Does that give you a clue? We moved him in 20 points. And I understand walk lists, and I understand concepts. I'm going to tell you a short little story. And I'm out of time. Well, thank you very much. I'm Kathy Wasik.
Just call me the enforcer. I'm sorry. Well, I'm very grateful for all four candidates, and give them all a hand. Aren't they great? We have several questions that came in, and I want to give a shout out to somebody who helped get the questions. First, you know that only on April 18th I became chairman, but I have a great executive committee. Vice chair is Kristen Williamson, and she is awesome. I said we want to give the people back a little part in this, and she her eyes lit up, and she said, how about if we ask for questions via Twitter? So it was her idea, and many questions came via Twitter. Also here is the secretary, Jim Rusk from Rantoul. Where are you, Jim? Wave. Jim Rusk from Rantoul. And Treasurer Ross Richard back there. Wave, Ross. Thank you. We wouldn't be good if we didn't have a good executive committee and a lot of volunteers. So here's what we're going to do now. Several questions came. I'm going to ask in a couple of minutes, I'm going to ask people to come up, the four candidates to come up, and I will start asking them. And candidates, you can answer as short as possible. If the answer is yes, just say yes, and it'll be enough. You don't have to drag it on, but if you need the time, take the time. I'll ask the question to all four, and then we'll keep proceeding. Also, if you have any comments for me, G for gorgeous. No. My real name is Habib George Habib, believe it or not. hghabib@gmail.com. You can send me an email. Be respectful. I know the whole deal, so just tell me what you think if you want to tell me what you think. hghabib@gmail.com. So, Kathy, I give you a few minutes to just get your breath back. Now you guys can come on up if you would like. All four of you. It looks like I have plenty of questions. I'll try to get through some of them. First category of questions relates to local and party-related questions. So Rod Burton of Champaign asks, what is the most important problem facing the 13th District and how would you address it? And I'll ask Jerry to start with that, and then after that we'll start rotating. So what is the most important problem facing the 13th District and how would you address it?
I think it's jobs, Habib. Jobs are the biggest problem we have here in the 13th Congressional District. I would address that by unburdening the small business people and farmers from over-regulation. I think that is the thing that we can do to bring, is the best thing that we can do for the federal government to bring good jobs back to Central Illinois.
Thank you.
I was told when I walked off the stage, I forgot to tell you who I was. I'm Rodney Davis, and I'm a candidate for the 13th Congressional District vacancy. And I proudly accept your nomination. Thank you. I got to commend Jerry. He always stands or sits me next to Miss America.
So we're going to have a sing-off.
Oh, I'm out. This will be no American Idol. I quit.
Do you remember the question?
I do, Javi. I do. And my middle name's not Gorgeous.
Yeah, thank you.
Jerry is right. Jobs are the number one priority. But I also want to talk about debt, out-of-control spending. I mentioned it in my remarks. If we cannot stop Obama and the Democrats from spending our nation into possible bankruptcy, we're not going to have a country years from now. Our children and grandchildren will not have that legacy that I talked about. What I want to do is have that courage. I want to stand up and be courageous to make sure that we say no, no, no to the out-of-control spending and what they're trying to do. That's what I intend to do if I'm selected as a candidate, and I will beat David Gill in November.
I would agree that jobs is the most important issue facing this district. And I think there are broad ways of addressing it and then also very specific localized ways. I think the broad way is pursuing fiscal policy and tax policy that reduces the taxes on small businesses. I think that right now there's sort of an unpredictability in terms of our tax policy. And so companies do not know whether they'll be in a position to hire someone next year. Also, with the healthcare mandate, they don't know what hiring someone actually entails. We have to have some predictability with respect to healthcare and fiscal policy. Also, I think pursuing some of the renewable energy resources and ethanol is something that could spur job creation locally in this district. So if I was elected, I would focus both broadly and locally on both of those issues.
I can say ditto to all three. But I think jobs in a different perspective. 53% of all of the graduates that are graduating from the colleges now are underemployed. There's a new term now for our graduates, underemployed, which is very sad. In my own family, I have two graduates from college that are now working as a server and working in a grocery store. That is very sad. And the other sad part of that is I have a son who's going to be coming out with $60,000 in debt. We need to change the whole focus. We need to look at this from a different perspective. Yes, children should be dreamed to go to college, yes. But at some point, it is very scary when you look out there and you're a senior and there's no jobs. There's a lovely woman here tonight who was one of the camera people. And when I said that, she goes, I know, it's a whole year and I just got a job and I was a server again. We have to do something different. We have to look at things differently. And jobs have to be it, but it has to start from a different concept and a different language than we've been doing it. It's not working.
Thank you. Next question comes from Susan Tolson via Twitter of Philo. She asks, what is your plan to support the 13th Congressional District's crowning jewel, the University of Illinois, to help it maintain its position in the world as a leader in research and discovery, as well as a local economic engine? And if I can ask Rodney to start, then we'll just go loop around.
Thank you, Habib. Besides buying a bunch of orange and blue clothing to wear to the games. You know, I mentioned in my remarks, education is key to this community, not just this community, but the majority of the metro areas in this district. We have to ensure that our educational institutions of higher learning remain the vibrant economic engines that we all know they are. What do I want to do? I want to sit down. I got to ask them. I'm not the expert. I want to go to them and have them tell me how their partnerships with the federal government are going to make sure that we remain that viable economic engine that we call the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana. I do want to say something. We have to ensure, too, that our leaders keep their promises. I'm one of those that may be affected by the bad, faulty leadership of the College of Illinois program. Promises were made to my family and to me when I paid money for those contracts to send my kids to an institution here in Illinois that may not be kept. We have to ensure that we get leaders in there who understand the importance of making sure that we get our promises kept when they are made. We cannot continue to invest in bad leaders, and we cannot continue to invest in bad programs, because you know what that hurts the most? That hurts the U of I. Thank you.
I would look to see if there are ways of pursuing public-private partnerships. Oftentimes, when we think about what are solutions, people think about that great pot of government money. But I think we have to look for ways of working with the private sector, because that's essential. And I think especially with some of the renewable energy resources here in the 13th District, that's key. We have some corporations that I think probably could partner with the University of Illinois and help to spur job creation that way and create great research opportunities for students. I think we need to stop thinking about just government policies, but look at working collaboratively with the private sector.
I also agree that the private sector is huge. I myself have created a program for the Lewis and Clark Community College in Godfrey Ware 15 years ago. I started the program, and now that's a successful program that trains occupational therapy assistants, and then I turn around and employ them. So what I'm saying is, like in this university, we need to bring employers to the university. We need to sit down with people. We need to have a better way of saying, okay, here's our graduate. Now, what kind of jobs are out there? Because I know when my kids graduated recently, it's like, thank you and goodbye. And they did not graduate from University of Illinois, so maybe that didn't happen here as much. But I can tell you in other colleges, they are not getting that connection to the employer. They're expected to go out and do themselves. How many people go online now and try to apply for jobs? It's a very different market. They need these skills to be able to understand, to get that graduate, that degree, and then transfer that to a job.
I agree as well. It's the research dollars that can be brought from the federal government back to the university. I mean, that is huge for our university. It's also about the private public partnerships. I mean, our university has an agreement with Rush Presbyterian Hospital up in Chicago, and these partnerships, you know, they help further not only education but the economic development. We have a huge research park here, and you know, it's growing every day. Our research park takes ideas that professors and students have, and it gives them an incubator to start their company up. And, you know, we need to expand that. I think the university does a great job. It's just keeping the funding coming.
Thank you. We'll start with Erica for this question. Terry Bush of Champaign asks, which, in your view, is the higher priority, serving your constituents or serving your party?
Constituents. I think when you look at the way our founders founded our government, there's a reason why this is the representative branch of government. It's different from the Senate. It's different from any other branch of government. And the goal and the focus is representing your constituents and their interests. While you certainly have firmly held convictions upon which you stand, you have to also represent a humility and the fact that there are people who are counting on you to be their advocate and their ambassador each and every day. So for me, that's a very easy one. It's the constituents.
I also agree. It has to be the constituents, because these are the people out there that you're representing. I have already told the party chairman that because I'm from a business perspective, I understand structure. And I'm not going to go to Washington and base my votes on how many yeses and no calls I've got. That is not the way you do business. What I want to do is I want to utilize these party chairmen and other people who are wanting to step up and say, hey, let's hear from the people. I want to call down, and I want to say, what are we thinking? And maybe those precinct committeemen, they go to their precincts, and they say, you have an ability to have a voice now. What do you think? And I've already been asking people, people that I trust and know in education and in farming and jobs, in employment, to say, would you be a person on a board? I'd like to see grassroots boards. And when I say grassroots, I don't mean lobbyists. I don't mean people in Washington. I mean people here. What is your problem? What do you need? Let's talk about it. And then they send that up to the Washington, and we have a dialogue going back and forth. I don't know about you, but I've called my representatives, and they've been like, we're sorry, you know, he's already made up his mind. And that's not acceptable. We're going to have a flowing conversation, and I'm going to work for you. And I guarantee you, when I get up there, I'm going to do it one time for one term. And then Chris Christie said, I'll let you know if you go back. You'll let me know if you go back. I'm not going to be presumptuous to say I'm doing two or three or four terms. That's presumptuous. My job, my contracts, I have to earn them every year. I will earn your respect every year.
Thank you.
I as well agree it is constituents, but I cannot think of any better way to put the constituents first than with our Republican principles that we stand on. So with limited government and things like that, it's just I think that is the best way to put the constituent first, is by our Republican principles.
I believe there's no reason why we can't answer that question by saying both. It's the Republican Party and the committeemen and the constituents that send you to Washington to put the high priority on the constituents. Now, there's nobody here on this stage that has served as many constituents as I have over the 16-year career working for a member of Congress. I've got a friend here, Doug Wilson, who called me one Saturday morning. He said, my son is in Spain on an exchange program. You know what? He's in the hospital in intensive care. And just so happened, Doug was renewing his passport at the time. Doug was a presidential appointee during the Bush administration. He could have called anybody that Saturday to try and help him. He called me. I often wondered why, but you know what? That Monday, Doug was in Chicago getting a passport, and that afternoon, he was on a plane to Spain to take care of his son. That's the importance of constituent service. Any one of you called me on a Saturday, you would have gotten the same response.
Thank you. We'll move on to questions about the economy. And Kathy, you'll start, please. Bill Lawless of Champaign asks, how would you articulate the critical need to sharply reduce the federal debt in a way that would motivate all voters to comprehend America's financial crisis and work together to dramatically cut spending?
Thank you. Well, here's what I would do. Remember when President Obama said, I'm going to go in, I have this person, and we're going to look through everything? Do you remember that? And then she left, and then we never saw from her? And then what happened? In my business, you have to go in and look and see, what is the fat? What is not working? What are we overpaying? Here's an idea. When you do it in Illinois, let's open the books. Let's get the books open. Let's look at everything. Let's look at the regulations. We need to come in and be comprehensive. As a mother and a wife and a business owner, I multitask. And that's what you've got to do. We can't just go down and say, we're only going to do this. It has to be everything, because we don't have much time left. I don't know if you're feeling that, but I'm feeling that. We can't go up there and just have one specific thing or have one mantra. We have to look at absolutely everything. I'll look at regulations. I'm going to see the business side of it. I'm going to see the medical aspect of it. I want Obamacare overturned. I want that gone. I look at education. I look at all the unfunded mandates. And here's my point. How is that going to cut the deficit? Because when you get rid of waste in your own home, when you clean up a credit card and you cut that up, guess what happens? You don't have that waste anymore, right? That's the common sense you needed in the government as well. I know they try to say, you can't run the government like your household. I find that very hard to believe.
I think I would articulate that by bringing it down to what we do in our own family budget. Like Lene and I have a family budget. We can't spend money that we don't have. The other way is that each man, woman, and child that lives in this country, you know, 5 years ago, we all owed $127,000. Is each man, woman, and child, that's what we owed. And now it's $164,000 for every man, woman, and child. And we can't sustain that. So that's how I would articulate that.
I agree with the first two here, but I would take it a step further. I'd love to have Dave Ramsey appointed Secretary of Treasury.
I agree with that one.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. You know, I follow those principles in my house, and, you know, it's something that I think we don't talk about enough in Washington. There's always the opportunity to talk about, well, we can't stop spending here. It has to happen. Well, you know what? That's what the courage is all about. I want to take that courage out there to Washington. I stood in front of many Republicans, as I mentioned in my remarks, and I cut an operating budget that they had. They told me couldn't be cut. They couldn't get any leaner. You know what that operating budget was? It was $900,000 a year to walk in, turn on the light switch. $900,000. Guess what I cut it to? 120. They said it can't be done. It didn't make some people happy. But you know what? That's the same attitude I'm going to take to Washington. And I know the federal budget. I know where we can cut. And we will not have any more Solyndras if I go to Congress.
I would try to focus on some of the foreign policy implications of our national debt. I think that it requires reframing this issue because people have often heard about comparing the deficit to the family budget. But I think when you talk about some of the long-term foreign policy implications, it starts to get people's attention. For example, our national debt right now is about $15.6 trillion. China owns over $1 trillion of that debt. When you have countries that own that debt, that really influences the way in which you can stand up to countries if you think they are abusing human rights, if you think they are interfering with some of the international obligations. If you are worried that they're going to call the debt, then you're in a position where you have to sort of stand down in your positions. So I think talking to Americans about the way in which this compromises our ability to stand up for American principles is a way that might convey the sense of urgency.
Thank you. We'll start with Jerry this time. Susan Butler of Urbana asks, will you support the Ryan budget proposal? If not, why?
I would support the Ryan budget in concept. There's some tweaks that I think that I would want to do to it, but in concept, he was right on. I mean, we can't spend money we don't have.
Ditto.
Thank you.
I support the principle of trying to reduce spending. One of the concerns I would have is I know that there are a lot of social service programs that were affected. My concern would be ensuring that those costs are not passed down to the state. Oftentimes, there's an interplay between federal and state government programs and the funding sources. And so I would want to ensure that we were not just cutting federal funding obligations and then kicking them down to the state, because that doesn't really address the problem. And the reality is there are people who are going to need these sorts of resources, and if we just cut it at the federal level and push it down to the states without providing proper resources, we haven't really solved anything at all. I would absolutely support it.
Thank you. Next, for Rodney, starting with Rodney, via Twitter, The Lowdown asks, when is it appropriate to increase tax rates?
The Lowdown.
That's a pseudonym or whatever.
Like Habib?
Yeah, like gorgeous.
When is it okay to raise taxes?
When is it appropriate to increase tax rates?
When is it appropriate to increase tax rates? The marginal tax rates? Never.
Okay.
Well, I certainly don't support raising taxes, but I'm not somebody who wants to make pledges that sort of would constrain my ability to perhaps
govern effectively. If, for example, our nation was faced with a natural disaster, or if our military spending and budget required it, I wouldn't want to preclude the ability to raise taxes. But my inclination would always be to look to find ways of reducing spending, because I think that's always preferable to raising taxes. But I'm not somebody who likes to make across-the-board pledges, because I think it sometimes hampers your ability to operate responsibly in the future.
You know, sometimes there's always going to be a crisis, and there's always going to be something that's going to have to get raised. That's what we see right now. There's always a, oh, but here's the thing. Here's why we need to raise taxes now. In the future, maybe that concept is going to be good, but right now, absolutely not. We've got to stop raising taxes. We've got to stop picking people apart and making, because you're over here, you get more tax than this person does. It has to be just across the board, an absolute no taxes right now. Go back to reducing the budget the way we talked about earlier, get the fat out, and that's where you're going to start finding some of your money. But we can't, there's always going to be that what if. And I think that's why people are so incredibly frustrated right now, because you send people to Washington to say, hold the line, and then they come back and say, but they said what if? What if? What if this happens? What if that happens? And then we go, we sent you up there to do the right thing. So right now, we can't make this, and I agree, you can't make a pledge for the rest of your life. But right now, it is an absolute no new taxes.
This past year, Pat Quinn raised our taxes 66%, and we are still $6 billion in debt at state government. So we're taxed enough. I would not vote for a tax increase.
Okay, and I think I lost track. Erica, is it you now up? I think, right? Yeah. Chris Beard of Urbana asks, what will you do to improve the current business climate and help business owners feel comfortable enough to expand?
The first thing that I would want to do is talk to business owners about specific regulations that might impede their ability to operate profitably. I think there are some specific provisions that I would identify, such as the Dodd-Frank bill and some of the Consumer Protection Acts that really harm businesses' opportunities to operate profitably. But I would want to talk to local business owners and say, in your industry, what are the particular provisions that really harm your ability to be economically profitable and hire new employees? Because I wouldn't be cocky enough to think that I would know what would affect each person's industry. So I think that would be the first starting point, so that we could start to stem the overregulation. But I would also want to focus on fiscal policy, because a tax policy is really imperative to ensuring that businesses can manage, they can budget, and they can be able to be ensured that if I hire someone today, I'm not going to be in the position of having to have mandates foisted upon me. So I would first want to have a dialogue, but then take that broader principle of starting to have some economic policies that help businesses.
Thank you.
As the only business owner in this entire group, I face that questions every day. And do we hire somebody? Will we have the contract next year? What if Obamacare comes in and says that we are mandated to have insurance for all of our employees? But here's the thing. When I started my business 15 years ago, people were saying, what starts a business with these words? I have an idea. And that's what starts every business in this country, whether it's a small one, mom and pop, or you're talking, you know, $500 million a year company. But right now, nobody's saying, I have an idea, because they say, I have an idea, but. I have an idea, but I'm worried, can I get the capital? I have an idea, but am I going to be able to face all these regulations? Am I going to be able to get the people? So we need to take that word out of the equation, and the government needs to be friendly to businesses, no matter what level you are, so everybody can dream that dream again. And they can say, I have an idea, and I'm going to go after it, and take off that but word, and start to build back that small business that really built our foundation. It is very scary out there. I do not think that I could start my business today in this Illinois economic environment, and also the federal. Just all the things that are coming down, it is extremely hard to keep it going.
And I think that we need to take that back to the saying, let's get people going again by giving them the ability to have that idea.
Can you read the question again, Heavy?
I'm on an iPad, lost it. What will you do to improve the current business climate and help business owners feel comfortable enough to expand?
I think this is the easiest question of the night. I think what I would do is I would help elect a new governor and a new state legislature in the state of Illinois.
You don't want to say ditto, do you?
Not this time. First, I'd ask my dad, who runs a small business, what kind of impact is this bill or this law going to have on your ability to keep people employed and to hire more people? He would be my first resource. All of you would be my second resource. But what I can tell you is, as a business owner, they have to be worried about the uncertainty in this country right now. If we don't stop the overspending, and we can't give them the confidence in our country once again, and if we can't give them some certainty on Obamacare and how much it's going to cost them just to run their business and provide jobs, they're not going to be able to create the jobs that we need. Small business is the backbone of our communities and the backbone of our country. And if we can't address these issues for them, we're not going to have that backbone anymore.
Thank you. Actually, I'm trying to inject some humor here. I really liked when he said ditto because it allowed us to keep moving. Robert, and is this for Kathy? I'm sorry, I'm losing my... Yeah, it's Kathy. Robert Dunn of Normal asks, and this question is about student loans.
Okay.
Recently, there has been much discussion about student loan debt and the lack of jobs for many college graduates. Tuition continues to go up as well. What is your suggestion or plan to rein in the cost of education and hold colleges and universities accountable? And I know you spoke about that. I'm asking the questions as they are,
sure.
Just to allow everybody to speak. So you can repeat what you said if you'd like.
Well, I don't have to repeat. I got something new.
Yeah.
This is where I totally get it. How many people have college kids in the room or going to college or just got out of college? I feel your pain. Okay. What we have to do, first of all, is we have to make sure that that person who goes and gets that student loan is really serious. I have friends, children, who thought they wanted to go to college, got the student loan, and then felt like, I don't really want to be here. And then I had the student loan. And then they may or may not be paying it back. So that's one thing. Let's educate people on, you know, and I think that's where a university can hold it responsible, because they can be saying, you know, okay, this is how much it's going to cost up front. It's like buying a car. You know, we know how much the car is up front, but the student loan just kind of goes like this year, and all of a sudden you have this huge bill at the end. So let's get people thinking about what they really want to go to school for. That's one thing. And that and then that commitment, because guess what? The financial bubble's coming. Have you heard that? The financial bubble's coming, and it's going to burst, and we're all going to be paying for everybody's student loans because they can't afford it. They don't have jobs, and I'll tell you what happens after 6 months when your child gets out of college. You get a bill in the mail from the government that says federal student loans on it, and you have to start paying right then. And here's what's happening. Remember, they're back over here at Denny's working with their master's degree. Guess who's paying for that bill? The parent then. So you got a double whammy. The parents are paying for it. So we really just need to sit down and have conversations with everybody. We need to have conversations with the universities. How many people have sent their kids to college, and in May it was one figure, and then in August it's $1,200 more, and you don't even know why? You know, we have to start looking at this like a business and say, okay, here's my agreement. And what about if we pay cash? Can we pay cash for our college? You can pay cash for your medical bills and get a cut rate. You know, I mean, I just think there's lots of things that we can start doing. We are plugging the same square peg in the same hole every single year. We got to stop it. We have to have new thoughts. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important to get back to your constituents. Let's have some boards of parents who are on having college, you know, have their kids in college, and let's start having some ideas out there. You guys are bright. You've got great ideas, and I think that's what we have to do is have dialogues with the universities.
I would agree with Kathy on the student loans. As far as the tuition cost, I don't think we want the federal government talking about what tuition costs should be. We shouldn't have the federal government in our health care plans, let alone what the tuition should be. But I know Governor Perry down in Texas, he put a challenge out to all his universities, and he wanted kids to be able to go to school for $10,000 a year, including room and board. I think that's an innovative way to go about this.
One thing I found is standing on a stage with fellow Republicans, everybody's got great ideas. It's a great opportunity for you to determine which of the best candidates that you can send to Washington to make sure that we take on the Democrats. I'm not going to repeat. I agree with Kathy. I agree with Jerry, and I know I'm going to agree with Erica, too, I hope. Don't say something, though.
You never know.
I may have to address it. But I tell you, one idea that I've had, before the mortgage crisis, we heard about, well, there's too much paperwork. I don't understand this mortgage. When the bubble burst, people just were blameless. Oh, I don't know. I didn't understand that. Well, you know what? We got the same problem with student loans. Let's make sure that when a child and their parent goes into the financial aid office, that they're going to know what this student loan costs them when they get out of school. Because they may make a few different decisions. They may take a part-time job to help pay for some of the college. They may decide to go a different route and maybe go to a community college for 2 years. The problem I saw when I was in college, you can clap loud, go ahead. Thank you. The problem I saw when I was in college, people just went, signed the paper, got the check, flipped it over to the other business office, walked out. Didn't even think about what it was going to cost them when they got out of school. We got to stop that.
Well, I do agree with that. I support market-based solutions, so I think a greater emphasis on community colleges is very important. And the 13th District has many fine community colleges. I have to give a shout-out to Parkland Community College, where my mother is. But I think when families start to demand that there's actual return on those investment of dollars that they pay in tuition and start to say, well, we're going to actually send our dollars to community colleges where we might be able to get a better return, I think that starts to bring it down. I don't think that it's appropriate for the government to start to set price controls because I don't think that's going to have a good solution and positive results. But I think focusing more on community colleges would be really important. I also think talking to young people about the consequences of debt is extremely important. I agree that that is the next financial bubble that we're going to have. The scary thing about student debt is it's one of the only types of debt that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. So oftentimes people are being able to have a fresh start with some of the decisions they've made, maybe a mortgage that was outside of their means. A student is not going to be able to have that same sort of opportunity. They're going to be saddled with an anchor around their neck of that student debt, and that's going to affect their choices in ways they could never imagine. So I think we focus on market-based solutions and then financial literacy so people understand the consequences of what they sign.
We'll switch to a new topic, and the next topic is energy, and we'll start with Jerry. John Bach of Savoy asks, do you support going after American energy reserves? If so, how will you as a freshman member of Congress make a meaningful difference towards that goal of going after American energy reserves?
I think the first thing is open up ANWR. I would be in favor of drilling in ANWR. Also, the offshore drilling, I would be in favor of that as well. And then I would go after renewables. I know Erica has talked about ethanol and a different blend. I think that's a great idea. And wind energy, I think as far as energy policy, we have to put everything on the table.
You're exactly right, Jerry, all of the above. But we have to immediately approve the Keystone Pipeline construction. It has to be done. Thousands of good-paying jobs are at the whim and wish of faceless bureaucrats right now. Coal, hydro, wind, solar, ethanol, biodiesel, everything. The only way to make sure that we have low-cost energy is to jack up the supply. It's simple economics, everyone. More supply, lower prices. less supply, more demand, higher prices. If we allow the administration to continue to attack coal-fired power plants, our energy costs are only going to go up. As your congressman, I would immediately make that one of my top priorities, is to ensure that the EPA cannot continue their attack on American energy sources.
Well, right now our nation doesn't have a comprehensive energy program, and I think that we have to be open to all options. I do agree with Jerry that nothing should be off the table, but it has to be done responsibly. I would support going after America's energy resources through drilling, but it has to be done in a responsible manner. We do remember the crisis that BP led to, and so there are economic consequences when you have a catastrophic effect of the right safeguards not being put in place. But I think we have to have a strong emphasis on renewable energy resources as well, and we have to move towards energy independence. Again, I think of the world oftentimes through the foreign policy implications. There are implications of not being energy independent, and I think that it's important to place a priority on that, not just because it will reduce the gas prices, but because it will make us freer and safer as a country.
I think that all three of these fine people said it very eloquently. I don't need to expand on that. I can say I have known personally what is the impact of the oil industry over the years. As I said before, my father was in the oil industry for many years. My husband was. My husband was a plant manager of a small refinery in Hartford that took out the what's called transmix, which is the gook in pipelines, and refined that and made that back into gasoline. Now, that he did that for 18 years. And I believe that not only another portion of our getting our energy going is to get the regulations off of our back, get the EPA off of our back, let these companies do what they're supposed to do. The crisis that happened in the Gulf, that's what it was. It was a crisis. And these companies are very, very well fine-tuned about what they know they need to do when they drill and how they need to be safe in the environment. I have friends who are from Alaska. They said, have you ever seen Anwar? It's a desolate wasteland. Right where they want to drill at, there are no caribou there. And the caribou have a really nice place down the road and some green and some pastures and some hills. So my point is, let's educate ourselves on what's going on. Let's get the energy going. All the above approach, absolutely. My first obligation would be to the coal fire plants as well. Get the EPA off of their backs.
We may have answered the next question, but I'm going to ask it and just give you an opportunity if you have one more sentence to say about it. Marguerite Zond of Champaign asks about the role, what would you do about, right now we have not a comprehensive energy policy in the U.S. and we piecemeal it. Do you feel that agriculture has a role in meeting it? And I think you guys answered it, so if anybody wants to expand, do. If not, we'll go to the next question.
I think that's Habib's hint to say ditto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
you're right. I mean, all of us agree that ethanol and other renewable fuels need to be a part of our plan. But I got to say something real quick on the last question. Erica, I'm glad you brought it up. We have to do things responsibly. In America, we've seen that BP spills are the exception rather than the rule. And we have to ensure that we do things in an environmentally friendly way, just like we're talking in DeWitt County right now. We need to ensure that the EPA, though, instead of figuring out ways to kill American jobs, figures out ways to ensure that they know that things are being done safely. That's their job, and let's make sure we make them do it.
Thank you. Okay, this may be an easy question. The new topic, Second Amendment, some of you already spoke about that. Mark Jones, through Twitter, of Pisotum, asks, what is your stand on the Second Amendment, especially concealed carry, including the concept of national reciprocity and a national concealed carry?
Am I up?
I think so.
Well, I am a strong proponent of the Second Amendment, and I would want to see the specific piece of legislation on the books. I'm somebody who would always be inclined to support anything in the Constitution. When we're talking about policies, the starting point is always the Constitution, but without seeing a specific piece of legislation in front of me, I wouldn't commit myself to any sort of national law.
As I said earlier, I'm a proponent of the Second Amendment, and I am one of those people who do have a concealed carry. And I know that several years ago, there was IGOLD, Illinois Gun Owners Association, had a march up to the Capitol. And my husband was like, hey, you want to go with me? And I'm like, well, I'm, you know, a woman. I don't know if they're going to want me up there. Well, anyway, I did go with him. And at that time, they presented the governor a rat tail comb, and they presented him a tongue depressor. And why do they do that? Because in the state of Illinois, it's on the books, not on the books, but it's a policy that if you're a woman, they suggest for your defensiveness to take this rat tail comb and use that as a weapon in case somebody comes at you, or throw up on them. Now, I'm sorry, but, you know, if a 250-pound man's coming at me in full force, I don't think that I may throw up on him, but I'm not going to use my comb to get rid of it. You know, I lived in Texas for many years, and we had open carry down there, and it was not crazy. People respect that. Now, guns don't kill, people kill. And we need to, And the people who are illegally going to get guns are never going to do something legal. Yes, I've been in psychiatry. I've worked in psychiatry for 5 years. I understand there's that one person once in a while that goes and gets a handgun and does something crazy. Isolate that person and take care of that person. Don't make us all be results of that. Thank you.
I'm as well in favor of concealed carry. We're the only state that doesn't have some type of concealed carry, and I don't think 49 other states are wrong. So I would be in favor of a federal law.
Kathy, I want to know the training program that teaches women how to use a comb and a tongue depressor, because I want to make sure my 15-year-old daughter doesn't go.
I agree.
Okay. Yes. I am unabashedly pro-Second Amendment, and I favor common-sense solutions like concealed carry and reciprocity.
I have many more questions. We only have 10 minutes left, so I'm going to move to a miscellaneous category. Stuart King of Champaign asks, what is your position on tort reform?
On tort reform. I'm just going to say one thing. My son is a physician's assistant student in Carbondale. A public speaker came to Carbondale and spoke to them about medical issues. At the very end of his speech, he said this: if you did not listen to anything that I told you, listen to this. Do not practice in Madison County because of the lawsuits and everything on your back. Now, that is pretty sad. Because in Madison County, I don't know, those of you who don't know it, it is the hellhole of lawsuits. So my point is that here, my son's being told, don't go practice there. So yes, we need tort reform. We need to get, especially in Madison County, it's a very big deal. It's a very big deal for the 13th. Madison County is in the 13th. So yes, we do need some tort reform, and I am living that every day.
Thank you.
I think we need to pass tort reform right now. There is not a neurosurgeon south of St. Louis. And it's the reason is because so many people get sued, so many doctors get sued. If you get into a car wreck in southern Illinois, you will be airlifted to St. Louis in order to see a neurosurgeon. And that's just unacceptable. So I'm in favor of passing tort reform now.
Good job, Jerry. I agree. I agree with that. And tort reform needs to be passed. Madison County, St. Clair County, is known as the judicial hellhole. And for the last 16 years, I've been fighting on the front lines to get rid of the politicians and the trial lawyers who keep electing candidates and electing judges that continue this process. Those of you who don't understand or don't know what goes on down there, let me explain it to you. Habib, I'm sorry, I can't say ditto. But what happens in Madison County is this. Instead of, if you got a traffic ticket Lauren, if you got a traffic ticket today, you would come back. I know it's not going to happen. I've seen you drive. So if you got a traffic ticket today, you would come back to court one day, whatever your traffic ticket said, and you would be in front of a judge, right? Do you think they know that you're going to get a traffic ticket that day and that you're going to show up that specific day? I sure hope not, especially if law enforcement officials are listening. Now, what happens in Madison County is this. The asbestos docket is given, dates are given to certain specific class action firms, trial attorney firms. Those slots are given out. You, Mr. High-Rise Class Action Firm, get these dates. And you, Mrs. High-Rise Class Action Firm, you get these dates. What? And then to top it off, that firm doesn't have to tell the business or the person or the company that they're suing when they're going to call the case. Now, that to me, in my world, is called stacking the deck. That's why it's the judicial hellhole of America, not just Illinois. And that's why I was on the front lines fighting to make sure that Justice Lloyd Carmeier won his race. I was fighting to make sure that we continue to elect conservative, tort reform-minded judges throughout southern Illinois. And you know what? The Democrats down there are scared right now because they've seen nothing but success on our end, and I'm proud to be in that fight.
I would support tort reform, but I would want to make sure that it really balanced the respect for victims' rights, because what's at issue in what we commonly call tort reform is how much someone can actually recover. And so I would want to make sure that we were able to have the kind of recovery that enabled people to have insurance, that didn't dissuade them from being able to practice their profession. However, I wouldn't want to limit a victim from being able to fully recover if they were actually injured. The reality is that sometimes accidents happen, and it happens through no mistake of a doctor, but a suit is brought, and sometimes it goes to a jury. What we would want to do in those circumstances is make sure a doctor isn't penalized and driven out of the medical profession, but we would also want to ensure that that victim is fully compensated. So I think it's really important to look at the type of tort reform. I'm certainly in favor of it, but we need to make sure that we fully protect victims' rights as well.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up with two questions. One of them is mine on behalf of the whole district, and some of you already talked about it. Gerrymandering has altered the district and made it less Republican. Do you have a plan to overcome that obstacle? And that's Jerry. It's your turn to start.
Yes, I mean, this district was drawn by the Democrats for a Democrat. But I think they used Barack Obama 08 numbers, and that was a fatal mistake on the Democrats' part. This district is, Cook has it, I think, Democrat plus one, but I don't think that's the case. It's probably, it's about a 50-50 district, probably leans a little bit Republican. So I think that any of us can overcome exactly, what the Democrats have done. I think they overreached here. And, you know, this isn't just about Republicans and Democrats. There's probably a lot more independents here than Republicans or Democrats. So you just have to get out the message to appeal to independents. And any one of the four of us will beat Dr. Gill. I guarantee that.
This district is a very competitive district. Again, Nancy Pelosi cannot return to power without winning districts like this. This district is a district that Bill Brady, who won overwhelmingly in Central Illinois, got 53% of the vote. In a year like 2010, in a landslide year where we elected five new members of Congress, a U.S. Senator, and two constitutionals, those aren't that good of numbers. Mark Kirk, 52%. Those were our leaders, statewide leaders. You know what? We need a candidate that's going to be able to reach out beyond the Republicans and Democrats. Republicans and Democrats don't decide elections. It's the people, unfortunately, I wish they would get more interested in coming to rooms like this and listening to candidates to see that we have better ideas. to see that we have better proposals, to see that we are better candidates. But you know what? They don't come. So what I plan to do in this 50-50 district is I plan to put together the best campaign organization, make sure that we have the funding necessary to win this race. And because we put together an organization like that, with all of your help, every one of you needs to be involved in any of our campaigns. Without you, we can't win. And without you, we can't convince those independents to vote our way. But with you on our team, we're going to succeed. And I hope it's on my team.
I think we have to focus like a laser on building coalitions. Because the reality is, oftentimes there are people who tune out Republican buzzwords and Republican slogans. And we do have to actively reach out to people who do not traditionally vote for this party and ask for their vote. And the work that I did on the national level in the steering committee of W Stands for Women and the Economic Empowerment Tour with RNC Chairman Ed Gillespie, those would be some of the strategies that I employed in trying to build those coalitions. I think it's important to realize that we have to be very intentional. I think there's often this belief that we can just put forth a positive message, people will understand that it appeals to their interests and vote for us. The reality is people who do not usually vote for Republicans need to see that we are willing to go to their comfort zone and humbly ask for the vote. One of the things that is essential is not assuming that people will just say, I agree with you, I'm going to vote for you. One of the things that Dr. King once said, in order to help anyone, they must first believe that you care about them. And the way that you show that you care about people is you are active and you are intentional about asking for their vote. It's asking them, what can we do to try to serve you? What are the things that our party has done that maybe has created a divide? How do we bridge that divide? I will use the experiences I had on the national level doing that to reach out to those voters and reach out to independents.
This is one area I feel really comfortable in. I told you earlier about, you know, the fact that of being a candidate in this race has already opened an applicant for the candidacy. I've already opened up dialogues. I've opened up not people who possibly be a little bit more Democrat, and also I talked about the third party. So I'm already actively doing that. Let me tell you something about what we did in Madison County and also in all the other counties we talked about. We took the message of the Republican Party's values and principles to the streets. We actually went out and knocked on doors. We had a concept called the swarm. And I know when they said, and forgive me, Rodney, when you said you're going to get that together, we've already got it together. It's ready to go, and it's already, it just has to be ignited by a yes vote. What we did was we did this. We went out, and I learned a technique from a group that we went to, and it's called swarms. And you go out and you take 25 people, and you take 25 people from your group and your group and your group and my group, or 10, and you get together. And then we utilize the great voter vault and the great walk lists and things, as I talked about earlier. We used all the tools from the Republican Party, and we made walk sheets. And then we took that organizational concept, and we stepped. And when we walk, we don't walk for a candidate. And I can guarantee you, and I've told every party chairman, I'm going to come to your town, I'm going to say, who is the candidate? Who is that conservative candidate that you want us to walk for? And whether it's the school board, the county board, or on up the ladder, we're going to all walk together. And we become a force, and we move through that area. And then what we do is we'll knock on doors, and we knock on 1 through 7. What does that mean? 1 is a hard R, 7 is a hard D. We knocked on doors where there was Republican or Democrat signs in the yard, and we flip people. Because sometimes those signs are there not because they want to, but because they had to. So my point is that we take this concept, and we would do 1,500 to 1,700 doors in one afternoon with the organization and the people. This is what elected Bobby Schilling, Sam McCann, Wayne Rosenthal, Dwight Kay. I can go on about 10 people in the two counties, and other people in Christian we went to. In Madison County, we use this concept. Two local Madison County offices, the county clerk and the county treasurer, both flipped Republican for the first time in 50 years. So this is the one area that I have to say that
I bring it home. I'm sorry. We have the forces. We have the groups. We have the motivation. We have the passion. We have the skills. We have the team. We've got the plan. It just has to be ignited. It has to be, obviously, everything these people have said. You got to get out to people that normally don't vote. But how do you do that? You don't get out there by going to a fundraiser and talking to people that you're preaching to in the choir. You get out there and you knock and you talk to people in their front door, and that's where you get them. You can't get them at a rally because they're there and they're gone. But you have conversations with these people, and when you look them eye to eye, they get to know you and then they trust you. And that's what you do to build this. So my concept is right now a whole bunch of eyes, but when I get the, if I would ever be humbled enough to get this, it's going to be a we, and we're going to go through it. We're going to roll through this 13th district, and we're going to elect as many Republicans as we can. And it's a concept that we've used, and it's worked, and it's very successful.
It's 8:03. Last question. We'll end up on a high note. You get to choose to talk about anything you want. This question is from Matt and Frida from Champaign. What issues are you passionate about? And we'll start with Rodney. What issues are you passionate about?
Well, trying to think of something new that I haven't mentioned before, because I am passionate about stopping the out-of-control spending. I'm very passionate about repealing Obamacare and putting in a healthcare safety net that's a market-based program. And I'm very passionate about continuing to help constituents. But one thing I'm very passionate about, and we're all standing up here asking for the honor to be chosen to be put into a five-month campaign. There's nobody on this stage who has the record and the experience of being more passionate about winning. I want to win this race so that we can do the things and implement the ideas that we've talked about all night tonight. And because this is the last question, Habib, I'd like to thank you for the forum. I'd like to thank all of you for attending this evening. I appreciate your consideration and the other chairman's consideration next Saturday, and I really look forward to earning your vote in November. Thank you.
One of the issues that I'm really passionate about is reaching out to young people who have had challenges in their lives. And that was really one of the reasons why I got involved with Prison Fellowship. And one of the specific programs that has had a huge impact in my life is the Angels Free program. It reaches out to young people whose parents are incarcerated. They're often alone at Christmas. They're without a father or a mother. And they wonder if anyone in the world cares about them. And this Angel Tree program, which I'm honored to be a part of, we deliver Christmas presents to these children on behalf of their parents. And we tell them there are people who care about you. There are people who want to make a difference in your life. We also had this event where we were able to have a prison allow us to bring all of the children into the prison to see their parents. For many of these children, they had not seen their parents in years. And watching these children and parents run across the gymnasium to embrace each other and to see each other for the first time was incredible. Those are the sorts of things that inspire me to want to be involved in public service. For me, it's not just the policies, it's not just the fiscal issues. It's seeing somebody who's hurting and somebody who needs someone who cares about them and being that advocate.
That's awesome. I think education, because I work in education every day, and whether it's a regular education or special education, I've already had some conversations with some superintendents, and the busing. Illinois is looking at doing different things with busing. The concepts that we have here in the 13th, the things that we need are different from Chicago. In Chicago, my son went to Dominican University, and they could walk all their kids to school. I went up there a couple of times and saw all these parents walking their kids to school because it was such a condensed district. Down here, we have rural counties, and we also have cities. But I'm talking about the rural counties for 1 minute. In the rural counties, you have to have busing. That's an issue. The unfunded regulations, the No Child Left Behind has to go. The race to the top. We have to stop these programs that they put on the school districts, no matter if it's an inner city school
or country school. We have to stop these programs and get the kids to be able to learn and not being taught to test. The teachers are under pressure, and they do such a great job, but they have to do all, they have to fight every day to make sure everything is done so they meet all these regulations. And then guess what? At the end of the day, a lot of times the money doesn't come through, whether it be the state level or the federal level. So education is a passion of mine. I'm in it every day. And that's what I would like to work on as well as jobs.
I think the broad issues that I would be most passionate about are agriculture and transportation. Some of the smaller issues that I would be very passionate about would be some of our small towns. Like, I don't know if you've read recently where the post office was trying to close down post offices in small towns. I think that's a tragedy. I don't think we can do that. Maybe we can cut back on the days, but I don't think we can shut down those post offices. The other thing that I would be passionate about are our wounded warrior programs. That holds a special place in my heart. Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the Champaign County Republican Party, I want to thank you for being here. I know you guys have had a grueling 2 weeks, and they're going to do many forums. The next one is on Monday in Sangamon County, and so thank you very much for coming. A long way for you, Kathy, and we are thrilled. I think we have about 250 people here, probably. Standing room, some people are outside. I wasn't sure if they're clapping for us or they're clapping for... But really, we are humbled that you took interest. We thank the media for being here. We gave the media 45 minutes at the beginning to grill those guys and ladies and gentlemen, and we're really thrilled that you came. I hope that what happens is that you feel that you have had a part in this, and that in November, no matter who the nominee is, that you will turn out in force and you'll bring somebody with you. God bless you, and God bless America.